Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location, finishing up some very important documentaries. This is an Empowerment Hour. You're going to find out everything about nutrition from the best institutions like Harvard University about nuts and what it means for our health. Also today, an in-depth, original investigative report. Scholar-in-residence Richard Gale and myself have spent the last 10 years researching the subject of vaccines. Together, we have spent over 20,000 hours in real scholarship. Because we both have a science background, both applied science and basic science, and he's very deep into molecular biology and the genome project and worked in the industry. We have done a careful analysis of, are vaccines safe? And if they are, what is the proof? Are they not safe? And if so, what is the proof? And we have our next in this series today. Please share this with everyone you can. I think it'll help save lives. In fact, I know it will. Also, tomorrow, we continue with our original in-depth investigative reports on Wikipedia. They must have thought I was joking when I said I had 100 articles coming at them from whistleblowers, people on the inside, telling the truth. That's all we're doing, telling the truth. It's something that the world public has not been aware of. The Internal Revenue Service Inspector General has not been aware of. The U.S. Attorney General and State Attorney Generals have not been aware of. Well, they will be after tomorrow, I can assure you. So, we're simply presenting the evidence, and then it's up for the public to decide, is this a place they want to go to for information? And is this a place that we want to keep its nonprofit status? That'll be on tomorrow's show. I said I was dealing very gently up to this point. That stops as of tomorrow, as you will see. Harder truths. Today, we're going to take a look at Rick Scott, running for Senate from Florida, former governor. You'd never know by his ads or constituency or the media how he made his money and why it's really bad politics. But that will lead me into an independent commentary that'll be very, hopefully, empowering to you. I'm going to take you into the business of numbers today, and the numbers that count, and the numbers you're not being told about, and the millennials are absolutely, totally tone-deaf and just ignorant of. But boy, do they need to know this information. This is not about identity politics. It's not about politics at all. It's about economics. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. Today, our first study comes from Harvard University, and this was presented at the American Heart Association's scientific session, and it showed that nuts, and we're talking about peanuts, which is actually a legume, but for our purposes, we're categorizing it in the nut family, walnuts, pistachios, they're all good. But most people like them as a snack. They don't realize how important it is for the latest advances in cardiovascular science for clinicians to be able to suggest to their patients, get them eating a handful of nuts every day, not the salted, deep fried, raw. Now, if you want to spice them up, you can. That's easy enough. You can put some Himalayan sea salt. You can put some tamari on them and give them whatever flavor you want. But eat them raw. In one study, there were two studies. One study analyzed the influence of eating nuts on long-term body weight in men and women, and the other study examined eating Brazil nuts and increasing the sense of fullness and improved glucose and insulin resistance, or insulin response, and that's great for diabetics and pre-diabetics. That's not at an epidemic level in America. It's at a pandemic level. When one-third of the American adult population are pre or diabetic, you've got a serious problem. So it helps you not gain weight. It helps you maintain your blood sugar, gives you energy, and the fats in the nuts are good for your heart. And they studied 47,000 nurses and 53,000 nurses and medical doctors in this study. So it was a huge study. So what's the takeaway message? Eating a daily serving of any type of nut or peanuts lowers your risk of gaining weight and helps you prevent from being obese. Also, substituting one serving of any type of nut in place of one serving of red meat, French fries, dessert, or potato chips can help you lose weight also. So, and it's good for the heart. So that's important. From Michigan State University comes a study about happy childhood memories are linked to better health later in life. What I found important about this study was that it's something all of us know. People who have fond memories of childhood, specifically their relationships to their parents, tend to have better health, less depression, and fewer chronic illnesses as they age. And that was published by the American Psychological Association. Quote, we know that memory plays a huge part in how we make sense of the world, how we organize our past experiences, how we judge how we should act in the future. As a result, there's a lot of different ways that our memories of the past can guide us. We found that good memories seem to have a positive effect on health and well-being, possibly through the ways that they reduce stress or help us maintain healthy choices in life. This was published in the journal Health Psychology. I would add something to this. I have a new film coming, and I have a whole lot of very wise men and women in the film. They have all been interviewed over the air over the last, I would say, 30 years in my Conversations with the Remarkable Mind series, over 1,000 interviews in that series. And one of those remarkable minds is Bruce Lipton. And back in the mid-1980s, he was the one who found, working out at Stanford University as a molecular biologist, and this was simply a afterthought. He took the DNA, which is like the brain out of a skull, he took the DNA out of genes, and yet the genes continued to function as if they were complete and whole. And that really puzzled him. And he said it took years for him to figure out what was going on. And that's the beginning of epigenetics, EPA, the larger environment we're in. Genetics are genes. Now, recently we had a gentleman on the show, a scientist, who talked about how a group of monks meditating on a word could influence physical matter. And it was not the first time that had been done, because we know that a baby loves to hear the little melodies that the mother sings or hums. And it's also important for the mother to be able to harmonize her energy with the developing fetus or the baby. And that laying on the chest, the baby's picking up the electrical pulses from the heart, something that we take for granted. We never think about that. But you've heard the notion heart to heart. Can we have a heart to heart talk? You broke my heart. In point of fact, there's reality to that. So anything that harmonizes energy, even if there's not a word or description of it in our vernacular, it's still real. Remember this. Please remember what I'm going to say. And if you really want to show how this is going to challenge science in the future, write it down. Reality always, 100% of the time, precedes scientific validation. Meaning, we have two primary groups of thinkers in our society. Those who do not trust anything that has not been first scientifically validated, and those who do not need scientific validation to trust their intuition and common sense and reason, even if there's no scientific validation. Now, how many of you have had this experience? Maybe when you were growing up, you heard your mom or dad say, oh, Gary said this, and suddenly 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later, 50 years later, I've been on the air 52 years, over half a century, suddenly someone, you know, I heard you saying that a long time ago. Yeah. We didn't need scientific validation to say it, to believe in it. Well, isn't it interesting that all the things like fiber in the diet and wearing comfortable shoes instead of high heels, look at the deformity in the feet of all the people who wore those high heels, including men now wearing those stupid pointed toe shoes. Yeah, it might look cool, but then your feet, your large toes going to have the metatarsal bend inwards. Now you're going to have a defect and it's going to cause pain. You could have it corrected with surgery. Most people don't. In any case, the little old lady in the tennis shoes was right. She was right about having her high fiber, walking with comfortable shoes on, taking your time eating, slow food, slow cooking, slow conversation, things that would 20, 30, 40 years later become fads. It was a way of life. So I just want to share that with you because the things that make a difference in our lives when we're young can help us have even healthier lives later on, especially if we've forgotten about them. We forget some of the things that were so precious to us when we were younger. It's time to relive those, recreate them, what I call living your life in reverse, meaning go back at stages in your life and try to remember what was happening, why it was happening, who was a part of it, what you were thinking, what you did, what you accepted, and how that impacted you, positively or negatively. And I can remember, because a month ago, I went back to my hometown. Now, 10 years before that, I'd gone back also. And I had filmed my neighborhood and my friends in high school and our reunion. Boy, am I glad I did that. Because I was just thinking this morning when I was out for my run, it was like walking into a massive abandoned ghetto. That's what my entire neighborhood, I'm talking about for miles, looked like. But back then, every single lawn was, the houses were maintained. These were just common, 1,000, 1,500 square foot working people's homes. And I remember in the summertime, there'd always be someone who would have a lawn that wasn't cut. And so my mom on our block, Miss Croft on her block, Miss Weeder on her block, different friends of ours, would encourage their sons to go out and cut those people's lawns. Maybe the person was physically limited in some way. Maybe they were old and couldn't do it. We didn't ask for anything. Sometimes they give us 10 cents. But we knew that we had to do it. Why? Because why not have all the homes in the neighborhood and the lawns look nice? So when you walk up the street, there's nothing, it's a blight. So the idea was that if someone was having a tough time, you jumped in, you helped. This wasn't a matter of the government. This is a matter of the people helping one another. And also, I remember the pastor in my church hadn't been a very nice guy. He was a young guy. The old one I didn't like. He was just starchy in his personality. And he really didn't like the fact when I was 10 years old, I stood up in church. And I was young. My poor family. Oh, my mother shouldn't have told it, Gary. If you have a question, ask it. So I had a question, and behind the altar is this, painting of Christ. And so I held my hand up, and you could see for like 15 minutes he was avoiding me, and then finally he said, what do you want, Gary? And I said, well, if Jesus is white, where'd black people come from? And you could hear this collective moan, oh, Blandina, leave him at home next week. But he didn't have an answer for me. It didn't make any sense. But I thought it was, if you're a 10-year-old kid and you have curiosity, you want an answer, right? In point of fact, no one was Caucasian at one point on our planet. Let's get over that. So all these people thinking somehow they're pure, there's no purity like that. All of us are mixed, going back far enough. In any case, I had this insatiable curiosity about everything. I took everything apart, didn't always know how to put it back together, but I loved taking stuff apart to see how it worked. And I had a neighbor, and my neighbor would have sassafras tea with honey from her own little hive, and I'd sit there on the swing. And I'd go over there almost every day after school and sit, and she'd give me sassafras tea and honey, and she would tell me about Tom Sawyer and other books. And that's how, that's why when my daughter was growing up, I didn't have a television or even a radio allowed. Instead, I read the classics every single day. And then, do you understand this? Do you understand that? What does this mean to you? So it was interesting because all my other daughter's friends thought she was deprived. And I guess she was. She didn't have television for 10 years, nor radio. Now ask them, how many of you read 2,000 classics and understand them? The Iliad, and can understand it. Moby Dick, and understand the existential meaning of it. She could. So at different points in life, we are motivated, and not always do we understand who motivated us from earlier in my life. And I credit that school teacher to being patient with me and our neighbor. I credit my mother with saying, if there's someone in the neighborhood who can't do something, go do it. And then in church, afterwards, with this new preacher came in. What I really liked about him was, A, he was athletic. And when he started to box with us, he said, no, don't hold back, because everybody was afraid of punching him. And we grew up learning how to fight. And so they'd let go. And he could take and give. And it made him more accessible as a human being. And he wasn't an Old Testament teacher and preacher. In any case, he said to my mother, who worked in the church for adult life, tell me who needs something. And then I would say, I was sitting there, I was a teenager at that point, and I would hear like 50 people. Well, Mrs. Thompson is homebound. Okay, who's doing her shopping for her? Well, let's get this person to do the shopping for her. And this person's needs a new roof. Well, then let's put together this Sunday, let's put together a fund and let's buy her, you know, get her a new roof. Everybody could do everything. It was just unheard of for people not to be able to do masonry, carpentry. Where I grew up, you could blindfold someone, they could put an engine transmission together. That's how much in love we were with cars and mechanics. So when I think back, and I was thinking back what it was like growing up and what I see it become now, and I think, wow, I was so fortunate to be one of the last generations to see what it was to come from community, all different religions, all different ethnicities, where we all worked together for a common goal, and we all respected each other. And there was civility, differences, which made us unique and interesting, but certain moral and social values that we accepted. Wow, what a difference today. So when I talk about de-ghettoizing America, I want to go back to how we live civilly and together in those communities, at least that did so. That was not always the case in many communities around the United States, especially in the South. And see if we can't de-ghettoize America. That'll be in one of my projects in the next 12 months. By the way, the next project is this Veterans Village, and it looks like it's going to get up and running. I'm interviewing some sergeant majors very shortly. In any case, this brings me to Bruce Lipton, because what Bruce was saying, and what he has continued to say, and what thousands of other articles have said on top of what he did, he rarely gets credit for epigenetics, is that everything and everyone, everything said, done, tasted, smelled, drank, everything that we have experienced, positive and negative, all become a part of our DNA. It literally shapes the DNA. The belief is just the opposite. That if you're supposed to have cancer, you cannot alter that gene. If you're supposed to have baldness, you cannot alter the gene. Well, I can show you that's wrong. I have male pattern baldness. Every man in my family, that's a whole lot of men, by the way, over 11 men, all bald. I was going bald. Now I got a hair so thick that I have to get it cut every week. Why? I exceeded the gene. Can we exceed the limitations of our genes? Yes, we can. Can we exceed the limitations of genes that have been programmed based upon trauma, abuse, neglect, lack of love, lack of support? Yes, we can. But we can't do it with the same mindset that is controlled by the epigenetic negative genes, the dark side genes. You can't solve problems using the dark side of your nature. You have to use the spiritual enlightened side of your nature. That's how you solve problems. Anyone and everyone I've ever worked with and helping them in their journey, It's never, ever a negative. It's always a positive where you start your first step. And look where that's led hundreds of thousands of people. So that's epigenetics. And that's what they're finding in the latest research. That's what they found in the Health Psychology Journal. They just didn't pull it back far enough to see the happy childhood memories are linked to better health later in life. Yes, they are. But you can also reprogram yourself from negative childhood experiences, deprivations, so that you're not forever carrying that trauma, self-doubt, low self-esteem, low self-worth, allowing yourself to be exploited by others. You can change that as well. I'll do more on that in an upcoming. I haven't done any for a while. I've been so busy with these other projects, but I'm going to do another webinar in the near future on how to reverse all negative experiences from our past. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Have we done it? Yes, we have. I'll share that with you on an upcoming show. Now, University of California at Los Angeles did a study, and it dealt with explaining the psychology of successful aging. Now, there's no reason that successful aging can't be the new norm. And we have multiple inspiring role models of aging. Remember the French Impressionist, Claude Monet? He began his beloved water lily paintings at the age of 73. And also, well, just think of older Americans, Maya Angelou. I knew Maya. She was on my show to talk about why the caged bird sings way back. I think that was in the late 1960s. In any case, in finance, you got Warren Buffett, John Wooden, Bob Newhart, Frank Gehry, the architect, Jack LaLanne. Look how long he lived. And he was vital right up to the day he died. Jared Diamond, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, John Glenn, Vin Scully. There's a lot of people in different fields who never accepted the limitations of aging. And just think of Gehry, that's spelled G-E-H-R-Y. He designed conventional buildings and shopping malls early in his career, and decades later designed the creative buildings he would only dream about when he was younger. Some other people have done their best work. Mark Twain, his best work. He was suicidal. He was going to kill himself out in San Francisco. Thought his life was a failure. Paul Chazon, Frank Lloyd Wright, Robert Frost, Virginia Woolf. So we have individuals who the older they got, the more inspired they became, the more unique and original their contributions. So when you look in the mirror and you think, gee whiz, I don't feel good about myself. I've got some sagging muscles or creepy skin or thinning of the hair or receding of the gum lines and all this others. That's correct, but you can reverse all that. So you just have to pay attention to the basics when it comes to ensuring your brain and body's health. Don't cheat, but our society is based upon the premise that we're incapable of quantum change. We are only capable of incremental change, and then we resist it. I don't know. I mean, Gehry, you know, the way you're talking, you know, it's kind of radical. I mean, you want me to give up French fries? Isn't that a little extreme? No, you're eating 21 French fries in every one of those little store McDonald's or any of the rest. And I'm asking you to take, you know, one glass of vegetable juice a day. And you're thinking you'll be overwhelmed and have nothing else in your life if you take one glass of vegetable juice. But, you know, having 20 French fries, you can do that without thinking. We are hardwired epigenetically not to change. We resist it. We'll apologize, make excuses for it. We'll be angry at the person even encouraging us to do that. That's the irony. Some of the people with the greatest animus against myself and others in the field do so not because we have failed, but because we have succeeded. Wrap your mind around that for a moment. The more people I help reverse disease and improve the quality of your life, the more anger people show. Why? Why can't they celebrate success? Because it's not theirs. they're failing, but they're rewarded. They're given an artificial success and prominence and deferment for failing. Oncologists, cardiologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, they fail, and yet they're rewarded. Succeed, you'll see how that goes. So don't cheat. Give all the junk up, and if it doesn't honor your body, mind, and spirit, don't engage it. Period. From relationships to work. And one final thing from the University of Texas at Houston. Just one energy drink may hurt your blood vessel function. Yeah. Young, healthy adults experience notable diminished blood vessel function soon after consuming one energy drink. That's according to the American Heart Association scientific session. And that is really bad for cardiovascular health. Now, I've mentioned that energy drinks are filled with caffeine and sugar. They're bad for your heart, your nervous system, and your stomach. And serious side effects. And yet people are gulping them down out there. And there's a big problem. You're going to end up hurting your epithelium. You're going to hurt your heart. So stay away from the sugar, the caffeine, because the lining of your blood vessels are hurt by them. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a brief break and come back for an original, in-depth investigative report. Please stay with us.
Just rising, I don't want to feel I'm in the wrong place to be real. Oh, and I'm longing to love you just for a night, kissing and hugging.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null. One of the things that we do on this program, and I believe one of the reasons people, especially activists, concerned citizens, listen in, is because we do a more original, in-depth investigative reporting than any other radio television program in the United States. Over 700 articles alone. This is added to that. Please share this. The title is New Vaccines Still Cause Autism and Our Government Knows. Today in the United States, in a growing number of other countries, the official policy is that any scientific study, regardless of its methodology and quality, author credentials, and peer review process, is summarily dismissed as incomplete, irrelevant, or unsupported if it finds a connection between any vaccine or combination of vaccines and autism. Even when the CDC's own immunologist, Dr. William Thompson, whistleblows and provides thousands of pages of scientific data and research proving a vaccine-autism connection. The matter is rapidly swept under the rug. In the case of Dr. Thompson's release of confidential documents to a congressional subcommittee, the CDC intentionally and with malice aforethought concealed their evidence that African-American boys under 36 months of age had almost a 200 to 300% higher risk of autism after receiving the MMR vaccine. The documents also prove the CDC has known for a long time that neurological tics indicating brain disturbances were associated with thimerosal-containing vaccines, such as the influenza vaccine. We have also known for over 15 years, thanks to a Freedom of Information Act filing, that CDC officials and scientists on the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Panel and the World Health Organization and every single pharmaceutical company that makes vaccines met secretly for 2 days at the Simpson Wood Retreat Center near Atlanta, Georgia, to deliberate on the what is called the Varistatin research findings proving thimerosal or mercury's role in the rise of autism. The meeting was held for the specific purpose of strategizing how to prevent the findings from reaching the public, especially the African-American public, and how to spin and manipulate the data to disprove a vaccine-autism connection. Keep in mind that this is the same CDC that for 40 years allowed African-American men and their partners who had syphilis, which could easily have been cured, to go untreated and until they had advanced syphilis, just to see what it would do to them, as if they were nothing more than a guinea pig. No one was held accountable. There was a belated and political necessary quick apology by Bill Clinton decades after this was exposed. This is the same racist-bound agency. Once again, it's an African-American boy that has a greater chance of becoming autistic after using the MMR vaccine than any other boy. And yet that did not make headlines. Where's the Me Too, the Stop Institutional Racism at the CDC and the FDA? It doesn't exist. What does that tell you about the value of life in our society? Private medical consultant Barry Rumack, medical doctor, was hired by the FDA to review mercury levels in children with an eye towards childhood vaccines. According to his findings, quote, these are his findings from his report, quote, there was no point in time from birth to approximately 18 months of age that infants were below the EPA guidelines for allowable mercury exposure. In fact, according to the models and blood and body burden levels of mercury, peaked at 6 months of age at a shocking high level of 120 NGs per L. To put this in perspective, the CDC classifies mercury poisoning as blood levels of mercury greater than 10 NGs. But all these children had 120 NGs. End quote. Also, Dr. Rumack notes that the FDA chose to hide this information from the public and higher health authorities and the scientific community. Unfortunately, the vaccine autism debate has been limited to only two issues. The MMR vaccine, following the controversies over Dr. Andrew Wakefield's findings in the 1990s and the toxicology of thimerosal, concerns over thimerosal are waning because it has been removed from all vaccines except for the influenza shot. And even the flu vaccine cannot account for the rising autism rates. Listen carefully to this figure. Since 2001, autism has steadily continued to rise. In 2000, it was 1 in 250 children. Today is 1 in 36. The CDC argues that this proves thimerosal is not the culprit. That's disingenuous. It ignores the 2012 Australian study published in the Journal of Toxicology and Environmental Chemistry that there is a direct maternal transfer of ethylmercury from pregnant mothers to the embryo and fetus. It remains American federal health policy for pregnant women to receive the flu shot, which can contain 25 micrograms of mercury. For the current 2018-19 flu season, approximately 80% of flu vaccines will be mercury-free. So one would therefore expect autism rates to noticeably decrease. However, the opposite is the case. So what else is contributing to the escalating autism epidemic? Might it be other vaccine ingredients that are being medically ignored as potential causal agents? Or might it be any and all of the three hepatitis B, 2 hepatitis A, 2 rotavirus, 5 DBT, 4 hemophilus, influenza, and 4 pneumococcus, 3 polio, 2 MMR, 2 varicella, and the annual flu vaccines children receive during the first 5 years of their lives? The science clearly indicates that the autism epidemic is not and never has been solely caused by the influenza vaccine, which continues to use a high mercury level, and the MMR vaccine. Although the MMR vaccine continues to be a leading culprit in autism cases, the entire childhood vaccine regime needs to undergo deep scrutiny. Studies point to the role of other vaccines as well. Doctors at Stony Brook University's Medical Center determined that male infants vaccinated with the hepatitis B vaccine prior to 1999 had a 300% higher autism rate than their non-vaccinated peers. The risk was greater among non-white boys. Now, one damning case of government industry knowledge about the vaccine autism connection is a leaked December 16, 2011 document from GlaxoSmithKline, one of the world's largest vaccine manufacturers. The text admits the corporation has been aware of the autism risk associated with this vaccine, which combines diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis, hepatitis B, inactivated polio, and the hemophilus influenza viruses. The report details adverse effects associated with autism, including encephalitis, developmental delays, altered states of consciousness, speech delays, and other adverse reactions. Now, while these revelations might be considered criminal cover-ups that directly threaten public health, they have had little effect on changing national policy over vaccine safety. Rather, the official denial of any possible association between vaccines and autism has hardened into an absolute dogma. And to date, there is not a single gold standard publication to refute with any certainty a vaccine-autism connection. Indeed, research from around the world proving a relationship increases, but almost none of it is coming from the American medical institutions. Unfortunately, the American media has also accepted the federal health officials' denial as absolute. Never do we hear the media questioning the veracity and scientific legitimacy of the vaccine doctrine. In fact, the media goes even further, embracing the principles of fake news to attack scientists and physicians and parents who provide evidence to the contrary. The media falsely frames the debate as a war between science versus parents. The argument is, what can parents possibly know about vaccine science? They aren't medical professionals. Therefore, we present for readers to review and reflect upon the proof of an unequivocal relationship between vaccines and autism disorders. Also, I find how much our society has been engaged in unique hypocrisy. Unique hypocrisy in that the overarching issue is legitimate. For example, Me Too. Yes, that's legitimate. But why wasn't it legitimate when Bill Clinton was being a challenge for serial rape and abuse of women, and to this day has not been held accountable? Why is it that it took famous people so there would have been no movement if it not been for Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby or Kevin Spacey? If it's just regular sexual abuse in the armed forces and prisons where men are raped at a very high percentage, that's not significant? But then we have another movement saying, I believe. Okay, you believe someone before there's any evidence. What does that tell you about you? You'd be the last person in the world I'd ever want on a jury because you've already made up your mind. If someone's accused someone of a crime, there's no need for a jury. There's no need for proof. There's no need for anything except punishment. Because clearly the person that you believe was right and everything else to the contrary is irrelevant. What does that tell us about you, your bias, your bigotry, your closed-mindedness, your simplistic way of thinking that denies evidence? My God. And then so many times I see them making Stormy Daniels into a new model for young women to follow. Okay. What part of that model do you want to follow? The fact that she committed adultery? She was married at the time with a man who also was married at the time? And then profited from it, knowing she was going to profit because she didn't find him attractive? When I'm looking at these hypocrisies, I'm asking, wow, What happened to the deeper thinkers? It's all politics, using any argument to advance a political agenda. So here we come to this point. We have more than 4 million parents who've had vaccine-injured children. Who knows a child better, a baby's development better than a parent? And now they see a completely healthy, normal child, and the child is given vaccines, a bunch of vaccines, and regresses. They're told by the nurse, the doctor, the pediatrician, the pharmacist, it couldn't have been the vaccines. So do we now say, we believe her, but not if she is a parent of a vaccine-injured child? Then we don't believe her. I see. The hypocrisy oozes out of some festering sore. So you believe one group of people without evidence, but others who have evidence, you choose not to believe them. Think about that for a moment. That's how far down we have gone into this rabbit hole of denialism. So unlike the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia, the majority of the governmental health ministries in the modern industrialized world do not take an official national stance on the vaccine autism controversy and other serious vaccine-related injuries. Only 19 countries, including the United States, have no-fault policies regarding the pharmaceutical industry for vaccine injury compensation programs, meaning you cannot sue the company, you have to sue the government. And that is almost impossible to win, yet people have won 4 autism-related injury. And this is partially due to the American and British health agencies being heavily compromised by private vaccine business interest. The revolving doors and conflicts of interest between these federal agencies and the pharmaceutical industry have been well documented. In the United States, members of the CDC Vaccine Advisory Committee are deep in the pockets of pharmaceutical firms. They're utterly compromised. The vaccine market is one of the most toxic cash cow scams in operation in the world. In 2016, MarketWatch reported that the technological advisory firm Technovieva released its global human vaccine market 2016-20 analysis, estimated the vaccine market will reach, by next year, $61 billion a year, and almost all that's profit. At the start of 2016, it was worth $24 billion a year. The enormous projection increase is due to global initiatives to push more and more vaccine compliance. Don't allow a child to go to school. Don't allow a child to be in daycare. Nothing that involves any official state, local, or government institution unless the child's had all these vaccines. Do they have science proving it will be safe? No. Do they have science proving it'll be effective? No. They don't need the science. We believe. We believe who? We believe the scientist. Because they're scientists. They say we need vaccines. Otherwise, we put children at risk. Well, hold on, let me get this straight. You're saying my unvaccinated child is putting at risk your vaccinated child. Well, if the vaccines work, why would an unvaccinated child be a problem for a vaccinated child? Your logic, the herd therapy, is just bone stupid. Do you have any double-blind placebo-controlled studies verifying that vaccines work? No. Do you have studies comparing one vaccine to another as if one was a placebo? Yes. Isn't that fraudulent science? It's irrelevant. We control it. How many new vaccines do you want to put into our children's body? Well, right now, we have over 270 new vaccines for both old and new indications in development, and we want to see that every one of those 270 go into every single baby. The report also predicted that the American pharmaceutical companies, notably Merck, Pfizer, and Abbott, have the most to gain. The industry also benefits from a $10 billion pledge by Bill and Melinda Gates to increase vaccine rates and compliance worldwide. I heard but haven't verified that the Gates are the world's largest supporters of vaccines, but I heard that they didn't vaccinate their own children. Anyone know that? I'd like to hear that. Another culpable ingredient now used in most childhood vaccines and also associated with adverse neurological effects is the adjuvant aluminum. And because the viruses and vaccines have been weakened, or in some cases killed, they are unable to trigger a sufficient immune response in the body. Therefore, an adjuvant is used to hyperstimulate the immune system to start producing antibodies. Has it been absolutely proved that the fact you have more antibodies automatically protects you against the antigen? No. Do we have people with no antibodies based upon genetic defects who are completely strong in the immune system? Yes. Do we have people who have a full load of antibodies who still come down with the condition? Yes. Then the entire subject is fraught with inaccuracies. That is correct. Therefore, they use these adjuvants to hyperstimulate your immune system. Without an adjuvant, vaccines would largely be ineffective. The critical question raised by Generation Rescue co-founder and author, How to End the Autism Epidemic, is J.B. Hanley, someone I had on the program last week. Quote, could an ingredient in vaccines whose purpose is to hyperstimulate the immune system trigger immune activation in the brain at critical points during brain development? Yes. Since 2000, as thimerosal was being phased out, children's aluminum adjuvant burden has increased, with more vaccines being added to the CDC's vaccination schedule. Aluminum compounds, either as aluminum hydroxide or aluminum phosphate, are the most used adjuvants found in vaccines, including hepatitis A, hepatitis B, DTP, HIB, pneumococcus, and HPV vaccines, or Gardasil. Each is given to a child. The human papillomavirus vaccine now starting at age 10. Hanley notes that in the mid-1980s, a fully vaccinated child would have received 1,250 micrograms of aluminum before turning 18. Today, that same fully vaccinated child would receive 4,900 microorganisms or micrograms of mercury. That's a 400% increase in mercury. A child's actual aluminum exposure is likely much greater because aluminum sulfate is used in the purification of our municipal water. One of the reasons I don't drink tap water, I filter everything. Drinking water may contain levels of up to 1,000 micrograms per liter. In an early 1996 study published in the American Academy, acknowledged aluminum toxicity and adverse events in premature infants receiving intravenous fluid therapy. A common argument against vaccine opponents who blame aluminum for a variety of health conditions, including autism, is that the metal is the third most prevalent element on Earth. What they fail, however, to acknowledge is that our gastric intestinal system is rather impervious to aluminum absorption. Only 2% of orally consumed aluminum from the environment is actually absorbed, and much of this is later expelled from the body by other means. However, when you inject and or have an intravenous aluminum compound directly entering the bloodstream, it's a completely different story. This is why the use of aluminum adjuvants in vaccines carries a high neurodegenerative and autism risk. Aluminum neurotoxicity in preterm infants after intravenous feeding, which then contained alum, was absorbed back into the body at a very high level. And we knew this since 1997. In fact, this was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. 39% of infants receiving aluminum-containing solutions developed learning problems upon entering schools compared to those receiving aluminum-free solutions. Similar to thimerosal, aluminum is a heavy metal that contributes to oxidative stress, leading to neuroinflammation and a intense adverse reaction of the central nervous system, the microglia, that leads to a pathogenic result characteristic in autism spectrum disorder conditions. The National Library of Medicine, the body of work that is given official approval, is the ultimate in science, lists over 2,000 different references about aluminum's toxicity to human biochemistry. Aluminum is dangerous, often found as alum or aluminum hydroxide in vaccines and food preparations, have been known since 1912, when the first director of the FDA, a man named Dr. Harvey Wiley, later resigned in disgust over its commercial use in food canning. He was also among the first government officials to ever warn about tobacco's cancer risks. He did that in 1927. The medical profession cannot argue against aluminum's ill effects on children. The evidence is overwhelming. Dr. James Lenz Wheeler at the Institute of Pure and Applied Knowledge has noted that aluminum levels found in vaccines are based on increasing immune efficacy and completely ignore the body's weight safety of a child, especially infants and toddlers. But even more negligently, the safety codes for aluminum vaccine doses rely upon a dietary study in mice and rats, never human beings, never human children. Quote from the Lenz-Wiler report, on day one of life, infants receive 1,700% more aluminum than would be allowed if doses were adjusted per body weight, end quote. The author is referring to the hepatitis B vaccine given immediately after birth. Now, infancy and neonatal states are the most vulnerable periods of human development, a time when individuals are most susceptible to transfer and uptake of toxic metals like aluminum and mercury. So if a pregnant mother receives a thimerosal-laced flu shot into the brain tissue, the newborns also vary in size and organ development and genetic disposition in a mother's environment in utero. So fetal elimination of toxins is also vastly different than the latter stages of development in life. In research investigating the elimination of ethyl mercury or aluminum in an adult has little relevance to that of a fetus. The fetus is tiny. Nevertheless, vaccines adhere to a one-size-fits-all model for their formulation and use. So if you were a 500-pound man or you were a 6-pound baby, you get the same amount of vaccine. That is extraordinarily stupid. By any measure, any doctor, any nurse, any pharmacist not questioning this should not be practicing health care at all. And yet, this is the norm. This is how unscientific the FDA and how criminally culpable for crimes against humanity the CDC has been and is acting now. So, with one-size-fits-all model and much of the argument for vaccine ingredient safety solely based upon published studies on adults, not fetuses and never infants. Worse, as J.B. Handley's investigation said, aluminum was grandfathered into pediatric vaccines without safety testing. So there's never been testing. In other words, injecting aluminum into the bloodstreams of small children has never been tested. This is supported by doctors Christopher Shaw and Lucia Tomovic at the University of British Columbia's Neural Dynamics Group, who has been investigating aluminum toxicity and autoimmunity. The authors state, quote, "It is somewhat surprising to find that in spite of over 80 years of use, the safety of aluminum adjuvants continues to rest on assumptions rather than scientific evidence. For example, nothing is known about the toxicological and pharmacokinetics of aluminum adjuvants in infants and children," end quote. Hard to imagine, but it's the truth. Shaw and Tomlikovic have conducted extensive research over the years to determine the neurotoxicological effects of vaccine aluminum and its correlation with the rise of autism spectrum disorders. There's already a strong correlation between children in countries with the highest autism rates and aluminum levels from vaccine exposure. The FDA established its measurement for aluminum allowance based upon the amount necessary to trigger a vaccine's antigenicity rather than concerns about toxicology and safety. In an earlier 2009 study published in the Journal of Neuromolecular Medicine, Dr. Shaw and his team demonstrated that the extreme toxicity of aluminum adjuvants contributed to motor neuron death associated with Gulf War illness. It was the first study to test aluminum in vaccines within a biological setting. Some of the research to aluminum adjuvant vaccines' toxic effects. Aluminum inflicts strong neurotoxicity on primary neurons. Aluminum-laced vaccines increases the aluminum levels in marine brain tissue, leading to neurotoxicity. Aluminum hydroxide, the most common form of the adjuvant used in vaccines, deposits mostly in the kidneys, liver, and brain. And long-term exposure to vaccine-deprived aluminum derived aluminum hydroxide, which is today an ingredient in almost every vaccine, results in macrophagic and mycofascistic lesions. I am only halfway through our article, but we're out of time. You can go to prn.fm. That's prn.fm and read it. Please download it and share it with everyone you can. Lives depend upon it. We're not getting the truth from any of our governmental agencies, and we will not get the truth, nor from the pharmaceutical industry, nor from the mainstream media. But we're sharing it here, and all of our statements are completely footnoted, and the scholarship has been reviewed for accuracy. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Another day, will I get through it without